Let me tell you a little bit about what I do and as a professional. I am trained as a physician and specialty trained as a psychiatrist. For a number of years, I worked at Parkland Hospital doing consult psychiatry, which means I would see medical and surgical patients on the hospital floors that had various sorts of psychiatric illnesses. Very early on in that doing that work, I found that there was substantial ethical issues that are faced by patients and families in those sorts of setting, in any hospital setting really, and got interested in what might be called bedside clinical ethics, or what we call today ethics consultation services for hospitals. Am I doing okay volume-wise?
Sure.
Okay, good. Everybody have a handout. Anyway, back in 98, a little over 10 years ago, I through a variety of opportunities and dumb luck, I was able to pursue ethics work full-time, and today I have a small ethics program at Southwestern Medical School that provides teaching to medical students, residents, and junior faculty, both from the standpoint of hospital-based clinical ethics, and also a new field is research ethics. And in some ways, I'm going to draw on research ethics here briefly, which I'll explain shortly. What I'm going to present tonight is definitely a work in progress. When Carl spoke to me, I was in the midst of preparing a grant with some of my colleagues for a very interesting University of Chicago program. They had a substantial amount of grant funds to support work on what they called the science or sciences of virtue. And so we were interested in thinking about how virtue as a concept could be fit into a larger social context. And there's probably more than one determinant in our interest besides this particular grant program. You may have heard through the newspapers or read in the newspapers that Southwestern Medical School, the University of Texas Health Science Center, has a new president, Daniel Podolsky. And he's sort of rethinking the vision of the school and thinking about how to remake certain aspects of the school. And so we thought that thinking about institutional virtue or organizational virtue might be a fruitful way of competing effectively for this grant, which is, of course, we won't even know the first phase until June. But also designing a project that would address what might make up institutional or what I'm calling here collective virtue. So that's sort of the background. And so I'm going to just go through what amounts to these slides and discuss them with you. So I'm now on the front page, the second slide here, or the second frame, the second panel. And so just in terms of overview of what I'm going to talk about tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about primarily the classical Greek concept of virtue that was primarily directed to the individual. And from there, then, I'll introduce this idea of collective virtue or institutional virtue as opposed to or sort of in contrast. Then what I'll do is I'll think about what it would mean to transition from notions of collective individual virtue into these collective kinds of virtue. And I'll talk a little bit about where, if there is such a, if collective virtue is a legitimate idea, which I think actually remains to be seen from our perspective, what would it look like? Where would it come from? In other words, what would be the basis or the foundation, so to speak, for collective virtue? And then I'm going to introduce an idea that I wish was solely mine, but it's not. What I'm calling virtue ecology is as another sort of set of brushstrokes into painting this picture about what collective or institutional virtue might mean. So now going on to page two. By the way, I've kept this intentionally short. What makes these things rewarding for me is the dialogue afterwards. My ideas are old to me. Hopefully they're fairly new to you. And certainly because this is a work in progress, I'd be really eager for your ideas, responses, comments. One of the things that we always do in teaching medical ethics to our students is bring the problems to light and make them more compelling by sharing a case. And so on the next panel, I'm just going to read this case to you, and I'm going to probably fill in some of the context so those of you who are not familiar with medical settings can understand what's going on here. Dr. Z is an internist working in an inner city clinic within the auspices of a large academic medical center, and we call them AMCs for short. An academic medical center is where clinical services are provided, usually with medical faculty, medical trainees, residents, medical students, nurses, and so forth. UT Southwestern is a typical one. It's the only academic medical center in Dallas. Another one close by in Fort Worth is University of North Texas. Anyway, Dr. Z's patients are needy. Many could benefit from participating in clinical research studies, but the patients are suspicious about being treated as guinea pigs and are reluctant to participate, even when participation would provide them personal advantage. Now let me explain that. Let me explain what clinical research is. A good example is in cancer treatment. Oftentimes the distinction between clinical research and standard medical treatment is blurred in the context of cancer treatment, particularly when one has a rare cancer and standard treatments aren't well established. And so, for example, in pediatrics with childhood cancer, in urban areas, virtually every child at Children's Medical Center who receives cancer treatment is enrolled in a scientific study to evaluate some facet scientifically of the child's cancer condition and whatever treatments it's being provided. But because clinical research is research and it's not standard treatment, everyone who's enrolled into one of these studies is given informed consent, informed about the fact that this is medical research, that you're not required to participate, that there are alternative treatments available, and then you're informed about the various risks as well as whatever potential benefits. And so that's pretty standard fare. There's a legacy in medical research in this country, particularly with minority and most notably African American populations, of distrust of the clinical research enterprise. That's where I mentioned the whole guinea pig thing. Some of you may have read about the Tuskegee study, which was conducted, I'm looking at the age range of this group, in most of our lifetime. It was, at least it crossed into our lifetime. This was begun in the late 1930s and was completed in 1970 when it was shut down because of ethical reasons. This was a study where a cohort, a number of black men in Tuskegee, Alabama, were enrolled in a study studying the course of syphilis, you know, the venereal disease, the sexually transmitted disease, which is very serious. They did not know they were enrolled in research, and even after effective treatments appeared on the horizon in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, these men were not offered treatment because the scientists, doctors, wanted to find out what the natural course of syphilis was. These men were not consented to, and once this became well-known public knowledge, particularly in light of the civil rights movement, the study was run by the U.S. Public Health Service was closed, and however, it wasn't until 1994, I think, maybe it was mid-80s, 1994, I think, when President Bill Clinton actually formally apologized to the few survivors of the Tuskegee experiment. And since then, it's been kind of a cause célèbre for problems in clinical research ethics. So that's the sort of the background. So doctors, so you can see on the one hand, particularly with minority populations like what we would see at Parkland at our institution, there would be a lot of distrust, well-founded in history, for people to get involved in clinical research. On the other hand, if they have rare conditions or conditions in which treatments are poor, in being enrolled in the clinical research project is an opportunity to obtain oftentimes the new and most promising medications or other sorts of interventions. So that there's this sort of plus and minus involved here. So reading on, Dr. Z's institution offers little in the way of community outreach, and Dr. Z feels in some ways his patients are exploited by the institution in that the institution wants to enroll a patient yet doesn't want to support true community engagement and give back to the community proper. What does it mean for Dr. Z to act virtuously as far as his clinical research and his patients? And so how should Dr. Z conduct himself regarding his patients, trying to enroll them in clinical studies? And then what sort of relationship should he define regarding his institution when, for example, what standard, the way standard clinical research is done today in most places is there's the expectation that the patient will come to you and then you will offer them to enroll in the protocol. But as you might imagine, lots of people who might otherwise be eligible can't come to you, and so some sort of outreach effort is required. So that's sort of the context. So now let me then skip to the philosophy part. And so now I'm on the bottom panel of page 2. One of the first things we should acknowledge is virtue is a concept that's both has philosophical technical meaning, right? It has a philosophical history, but it also has use in ordinary language. And one of the things I'm sure you all are aware is that one of the ways we can get mixed up or get a field in philosophy is when we switch from ordinary language meanings of words to technical philosophical meanings. So what I did is just copied and pasted out of dictionary.com. You know, we think of ordinary language virtue being moral excellence, conformity to moral standards or principles. We talk about a woman's virtue in the sense of being chaste. And then there's a variety of these other ones, these other meanings. So I want to just remind everyone of the ordinary language meaning of virtue. And then I'd like to very briefly sort of summarize in my own terms, my own language, this sort of classic Greek concept of virtue as articulated by Plato and then later Aristotle. And so what I've done is I just sort of digested it down into this simple statement in that the Aristotelian concept of virtue can be simply stated, individuals should cultivate habits of character through the practice of good deeds aimed at individual and collective well-being, or eudaimonia. So there's several facets to this sort of notion of virtue that I just wanted to call attention to or emphasize. The first thing is that virtue isn't the same as a value. Although certainly virtues are values, but virtues are something more specific. They're really something that we have to cultivate. And so there's a certain labor involved in virtue. We can those of you who have been parents know the virtue of temperance or restraint and patience, those sorts of virtues, right? There are many times when our children test our temperance. And indeed, oftentimes it takes great effort for us to be patient with our children. And if we fail, oftentimes then we feel badly. And so part of the concept of virtue has to do with the sense of labor, that ordinary life tests our ability to live virtuously. Then the second one is the notion of habit. And in a sense, virtues point to an ideal, and the ideal is that once we persevere in the cultivation of the doing particular kinds of good deeds, then we'll develop particular habits and that labor becomes less intense. And so again, using my parent example, when we are beginning parents and we have crying babies, they might unravel or unglue us more than after the second or the third child comes along, and we're sort of seasoned and we sort of know what to do, and we have our habits, our virtuous habits in parenting are sort of set in place. Now, the other issue, you know, is the idea of good deeds, and of course this is something that could fill up a discussion unto itself. I've stated it here sort of baldly, but the whole idea of what a good deed is something that's problematic and would need to be specified. And then finally, the sort of metaphysical notion that Aristotle particularly talks about, having to do that virtue has a particular telos or goal-directedness. That is, that virtue is directed toward the goal of eudaimonia, which is sometimes translated as well-being, other times as human flourishing. And the basic notion here is that we want to aim our virtues toward not just individual doing well, but collective doing well as well. So then on the last panel on page 3, one of the problems, I think, or what's somewhat unsatisfying in reading Greek treatments of virtue is that it's what I might call pragmatically poor, both from the standpoint of even within the historical period it was created, but also how these sorts of, for example, how one obtains eudaimonia or human flourishing individually and together today. In other words, what practices should we do? And more pertinently, as we'll talk about later, what do we do when two or more virtues are in conflict? That is, how do we decide which virtue to respect versus others? And so one of the notions that comes up in the Greek treatment of virtues is it's a sort of bottom-up. What I mean by bottom-up is that they have this sort of metaphysical idea about what the metaphysical goals of human beings are, that is, human flourishing. And so we then determine or shape our behavior from that context or that framework. Now I'm on page 4, top panel. One of the things that we also recognize from our ordinary, you know, education and reading the newspaper today, you know, in philosophy, one of the branches of philosophy that's currently sort of trendy is what's called moral psychology. And the idea here is how morals and morality, ethical issues, virtues play out in ordinary life, and what sort of capacities human beings have to make use and practice various sorts of moral ideas or ideals. And so one of the sort of ordinary experiences that we have today is that moral psychology today is both what I would call bottom-up and top-down. That is, we have the experience of being guided by our own internal moral principles, beliefs, sense of virtues, and so we try to live by them, like with the parenting example, correct? But we also have the experience of being tested and being influenced by social, collective sorts of influences. And so I've got a couple of examples here. So for example, there's, in terms of just ordinary common sense mottos, one, we say one person can make a difference. That is that as a moral actor, you know, we can really, one person can indeed change not only themselves but others. But we also have the experience where the collective, society, social groups, family, whatever, however big the collective you want to consider, we also have the experience of where they influence us. I mean, we pass laws that we have to adhere to. What I have this is a Japanese expression, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. The idea is that there's certain mores that we are expected to conform to, and life becomes difficult for us if we don't follow. So the idea of the moral life, we get pushed by our own internal interests and sense of moral value and purpose, but we're also pushed in particular directions by social conditions. And then, and so sort of derivative from that is we all have what I'm calling universal experiences of corruption of well-meaning social institutions. I mean, you know, what's in the news today, you know, heaven forbid, I don't know what your politics are, but, you know, the current discussion about, in my field, the use of healthcare professionals, physicians, psychologists, and torture in the post-9/11 era. That's something that, if true, is provocative and could well be, you know, represent corrupting social influences in terms of individual virtue. You know, physicians are not, are basically expected to not participate in torture as part of their professional practice. So then second, I mean the last panel there, so we've talked about this idea of top-down sort of induction or promotion of well-being. The classic example in the governmental sense is the development of the U.S. Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution. A group of people got together to develop principles, collectivist sorts of rules to help found the United States, you know, with principles of democracy, which you're all familiar. So what this is all sort of building toward is, as opposed to sort of the bottom-up classical Greek approach, to the more contemporary moral psychology is it that there's this sort of give and take, this equilibrium between my push for individual virtue interests on the one hand, and then my response to and conforming to or remodeling of, or participation remodeling of, social collective sorts of notions of virtue. Everybody following me so far? So then on page 5, so a number of questions, you know, arise here, and I don't have all the answers to these, and that's why I'm sort of posing them to you all. And of course, these are perennial problems in virtue theory that have been explored in the centuries following the Greeks. How does the pursuit of individual virtue contribute to collective well-being? So how is it that you and me, as individual good people who cultivate our own direction, how do we make the world better for others? How does the pursuit of collective well-being contribute to individual well-being? And so just the opposite question. And then the tough ethical question, what do we do when the individual virtue and collective virtue conflict? And the classical example of this is, again, very prominent in my field in medicine today, is around conflicts of interest. For example, physicians who engage in clinical research are permitted to develop financial arrangements with pharmaceutical companies or drug device manufacturers. And they'll develop very lucrative contracts to, for example, go on a lecture circuit or serve on an advisory panel, and they'll pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to physicians to serve. So on the one hand, physicians want to provide high-quality advice to drug and device manufacturers so that their products could be improved, while at the same time, they're accepting really substantial payment. And so the question is, whose interests are really being served here? When you then complicate matters by having the same physicians participate in scientific studies of those drugs or devices, then can they be truly objective? And will there be intentional or accidental skewing of research design, collection of data, and so forth. So these sorts of conflicts between pursuing legitimate quality medical drugs and devices also can conflict with, for example, one's duty to taking care of patients and protecting their particular interests. So that's what conflicts of interest are about. We have two virtues, that is, developing high-quality drugs and devices, and then looking out and providing quality care for patients. Those two are in conflict. The public, justifiably so, is uncomfortable with those, and so there's been enormous discussion in the medical field about how to manage these sorts of conflicts of interest. We're not going to focus a lot on that. That's just an example of how virtues can conflict. So the reason I spent all this time talking about individualistic sorts of virtue, the classical notion of virtue, is there's a real legitimate philosophical question whether or not moving from individual notions of virtue to collective notions of virtue are even valid. That is, that the concept as it was conceived by the Greeks applying to individuals, does it really apply to groups? And if it does, how would it? Or is it really more of a metaphysical sense of virtue, or more one of these commonsensical senses of virtue that we started out with? So then on page 6, I've sort of covered that first point. One of the ways that we can think of, so if we have for individualistic sorts of the classical notion of virtue, that comes from the Greek metaphysical account of the individual. But if we were to think then, what would it mean for example, like a academic medical center to act virtuously? What would that mean? And more pertinently, from where would we derive the virtues? It's sort of the metaphysical account of the institution doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In some ways, it's dependent upon a collective of individuals. And so we then have this sort of problem, this rather tall intellectual problem of synthesizing how an academic medical center like mine that employs almost 5,000 people, how they collectively come together to exhibit collectivist virtue. So that, doing some sort of algebraic sum of individual virtue to derive collective virtue doesn't make a lot of sense. So where might they come from? Well, one obvious place that most institutions that are formalized and organized, they usually form institutional goals and articulate mission statements, particularly service institutions like hospitals or churches or even business organizations can have mission statements. And so that might be a potential source of where collective virtues might emerge. And then, of course, the other possibility, which I think is in some ways probably the more philosophical source, is we derive social notions of virtue from, for example, religious belief systems and what amounts to political philosophies. And so different kinds of political belief systems that are articulated by the classic political philosophers from Hobbes to Machiavelli to John Rawls all present their own sort of vision of how collectivities, societies, can pursue human flourishing in the Greek sense. And so those are sort of the sources of collective virtue from the philosophical side. So one of the problems that we would like to do with our project for the Science of Virtues project is we would like to be able to capture what collective or institutional virtue would mean for Southwestern Medical Center. And one of the ways that we would do that is the way I've sort of articulated it, is by looking at things like mission statements and institutional goals and objectives, but also, for example, looking at historical accounts of Southwestern, seeing what are the kinds of values that were pursued, and to see if there were virtue-like or aretaic guiding principles that recur. And those might be then sources of institutional virtue. The other way, I think, of framing collective virtue as opposed to individual virtue is by contrasting one of Aristotle's pragmatic sort of rules for pursuing individual virtue. You all probably know that Aristotle said in terms of virtue, one should pursue the mean. That, so for example, excessive courage then leads to bad outcomes. Excessive temperance, excessive patience means that one oftentimes lapses into passivity. If you're a parent, if you're excessively patient, then the child never learns or is never disciplined enough. So there's a certain moderation. There's the median path that one should pursue. So that was sort of one of the components of how to lead the virtuous life in the context of all these multiple virtues. If you think about collectivist virtue, pursuing the mean is more obscure, it seems to me. So what does it mean to pursue, for example, Southwestern Medical Center to pursue a moderate temperance in its affairs? It doesn't apply readily. And so one of the reason I talked about this bottom-up and top-down business is perhaps it's not so much pursuing the meaning with collective virtue that's important, but rather pursuing balance. And balance is a term that's emerged in the 60s as sort of one of the founding virtues, so to speak, of the ecology movement. And so let me just give you an ecological example. If we were all to, let's say we were in a country lodge in Colorado tonight, and we looked outside the window and we saw a deer grazing outside, and a pack of wolves came up, attacked the deer, tearing it to pieces and feeding. And most of us would be appalled and would find this repulsive. However, even though our gut reaction is to being appalled, if we take the larger ecological view of balance, then we can see this, we can recognize from the broader context that if the wolves weren't doing their predatory role in keeping the deer population down or controlling the deer population, the deers would overgraze, devastate the plant life, and so forth. So there would be pretty substantial environmental repercussions. And so this idea of balance then might be a way in thinking about collectivist virtues in terms of an ecology, might be a way for us to think through in terms of how to practice within practice virtuously within a collective. Now I'm on page 6 now. I've gone through a lot of those examples. Let me keep going. I mean, on page 8 now. Let me go to page 9. You know, when I was talking about this with my philosopher colleagues at Southwestern, he gave a really poignant example of a constraint, a potential constraint on this idea of virtue ecology and balance being, you know, sort of a guiding principle as opposed to pursuing the mean. He said, this is a father of 4 school-age children, one of whom's a, you know, 11-year-old, 12-year-old daughter. So he gave the example of the child molester. And it's, so the child molester, you know, there's nothing that I can see other than wrongful predation, predatory behavior in this individual. And so my response was, well, you know, I can understand that. But even it within, you know, ecological concepts, there are what we might call perversities. That is that there are behaviors that that don't strike the balance. That, so for example, if we were to go back to the wolf example, what if the wolves were rabid and were then killing deer, not for the sake of feeding, but for the sake of killing, out of madness, so to speak, of animal madness? Then that would be a perversity, an ecological perversity based on disease, and then we can then think of this notion of perversity as pursuing an excess of a particular otherwise ecologically correct behavior as a way of then thinking about the opposite of virtue or vice. So if we then go back to the case of I thought I'd leave this with a potential discussion point. If we think about the case of Dr. Z, who is struggling with how to act virtuously both in deference to his institution as well as in deference to his patients, how would these notions of perhaps mean, pursuing the mean for individual virtue, or pursuing the notion of balance in terms of the sort of virtue ecology, help us address his particular dilemma? So at that point, I'll stop and welcome your comments, questions, or discussion points. Thanks for your attention.
All right. Please keep your questions to a question, and I guess proceed.
They can't make comments?
Yeah, you can make comments, but we can have a discussion, but sometimes we get sermons. I mean, we've had those before, but anyway.
Okay. Well,
it's not too good, but anyway.
As long as everyone gets a chance.
Yeah, so anyway, got one right here.
Are you familiar with Kohlberg's stages of moral development?
Well, yes.
Because it occurs to me that if you apply this in that context, then the social or collective virtue would be the intermediate stage, you know, the conventional moral stage, whereas the pre-conventional and the post-conventional both have a more individualistic emphasis.
Uh-huh.
And so the sort of the use of a social norm as the definition of virtue would be the middle stage there. You've got the individuals that are not morally developed enough to internalize the social norm, and then you've got those like a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi who are advanced enough that they can criticize the social norm and transcend it. So that's one possible way of relating the individual and the collective virtue.
You know, No, that's really an interesting idea. You know, Kohlberg's theory has been controversial in feminist circles because of the idea that pursuing individualistic sorts of justice concepts over collectivistic justice concepts. A lot of feminists don't
believe.
Carol
Gilligan.
Gilligan's a good example, yeah.
Right, yeah. But I don't know that she so much clashed with Kohlberg as she sort of refined it that men and women navigate through that in a different voice, but I think she would agree they go through those same three stages. It's just that women tend to show up a little differently in the way they navigate through that than men do, would be my understanding of Gilligan's conclusion.
Okay. Question right here.
Yes, sir.
I'd like you to clarify the stance from which you regard this as a scientific investigation.
Oh, okay. So I was talking about the philosophy.
And on the other side of that, you have taken some pains, I think, to configure this in terms of philosophy and secular concepts of virtue. There was one line on one of your slides where you talked about the possibility of religion entering into it. So
sure.
you could address that as perhaps the other side of the distinction I'm asking you to look at.
Well, I didn't tell you anything about the science part of the project, which is a social science project. One of our collaborators is an anthropologist. And what anthropologists do is what's called qualitative research. And what, in essence, they do, what we want to do is go from a variety of clinical, administrative, and educational settings in the institution and interview people, do focus groups, record them, and to ask them key questions about, you know, what's important about Southwestern Medical Center. What do you think is the guiding principles of the conduct of this clinic and so forth? And that these are recorded, and today now there are software programs that can identify particular semantics in text transcriptions that can give you actually quantitative information about people's various sorts of beliefs. Over a number of series of interviews. And so the basic objective of this part of the project is to look at what are the stated goals, missions, what are the prevailing values that Southwestern Medical School preaches, so to speak, if I can borrow a religious verb. And then we want to go into the actual nitty-gritty on-the-ground practices and see what is in fact practiced to see whether it matches or does not match the practice. So if we say the patient is the most we have a patient-centered hospital, then we want to see assessments in the clinics and in the hospital where patients feel that they come first in order to match the principle to the practice. So that's, in essence, the scientific portion of what we're doing.
I am waiting to hear how the observations that you can make there in that relationship relate to conclusions about virtue.
Yes. Right. Well, what we're interested in doing is looking at these particular practices and then seeing what sorts of empirical values as embodied in a particular practice emerge, and then those might give us some clues about what kinds of virtues might emerge, might be exhibited in the academic medical center. And then, of course, we would want to critically look at those and see, well, if that's what we found, is that really the ideal? And so then we would want to subject that to our own sort of later set of philosophical reflections.
Okay.
critically evaluated companies.
You mentioned for the first time the word that I've been looking for since the beginning is values, as opposed to virtues.
Yes. Yeah, one of the things we wanted to clarify was the difference between virtues and values. And we had our own account of it in our proposal. And what we really see as our virtues are values or sets of values that are organized into practices and standards. So for example, we might say we want to be nice to each other. But that's not necessarily going to be a standard from which that's a value, but it may not be a standard, a virtue, that which we want to promulgate as a general principle for the institution.
I'd like to throw one out here. You're talking about institutional virtue.
Yes.
And somehow individual virtue is going to play into that, I think. The question would be, is can you have institutional virtue without individual virtue?
Well, you know, what Plato thought was the way collective, what I'm calling collective virtue, emerges in societies, you know, is in the whole account of, you know, there's a section where he talks about the whole guardianship account. I think it's in the Republic. Where he talks about each individual has their various talents and has particular social roles, and collectively there's this sense of complementarity where individual endeavor then comes together to advance collectivist sorts of flourishing. And so for Plato, absolutely the individual role is important. You know, what's curious to me, I don't want to digress too far away, but what's curious to me when we were thinking about the classic individualistic notion of virtue is something a colleague who, in a rather self-revealing fashion, claims that what motivates clinical scientists is fame and fortune. And so, I mean, that sounds very greedy and selfish, right? And that led me to wonder, certainly that's the way the world operates, and there are certain individuals who, through excess, I mean, for example, and you've mentioned some of them, Gandhi, not that it was a particular kind of excess that Gandhi practiced, that turned out to be very effective. And so I think from this notion of ecology and balance, we have to be careful to not judge excesses as vice until we can really understand the broader picture and see how someone who stages sit-ins and is socially disruptive, certainly we could see that as vice-laden on the one hand, until we understand the larger function and the sense of balance that Gandhi was bringing to larger social forces within a society. So that's what, so going back to my example of the selfish investigator, there are some people out there who, for selfish reasons, pursue the cure for cancer, and are we correct to condemn them for their excesses when in fact they confer great social benefit and in a certain sense a certain amount of personal sacrifice for it? I mean, is that
clear?
Yes.
Yeah. I have an interest in the methodology. Or come up with a new design for your mission or objective and so forth. And I presume we're in instance, that one of the questions that you'll describe the answers of what Unique seems to do.
Right.
And so I was kind of curious about, you've kind of described a little bit about the process when you talk about focus groups, but in terms of designing this mission and also maybe articulating your virtue, or are you going to do here are the virtues that we think we want to exhibit, and did our attempts at defining mission address those virtues, or have you
No, I think it's a really good question. It's really key. And to some extent, now I'm going to shift to continental philosophy and say this is a sort of a hermeneutic process of going back and understanding the part and the whole and so forth. Let me give you one of the things. Let me respond by an example that's problematic that we mentioned in our proposal. By the way, this may never happen if we don't get funding, because it costs money to do it. So don't come back and say, how did it go? Because it may never happen. If you get into this notion of institutional virtue, there's been some work done in business ethics in this regard. And none other than a very esteemed Texas philosopher, I believe is recently deceased, or fairly recently deceased, Robert Solomon of UT Austin. And Solomon was actually really interested in the idea of institutional virtue in the context of business ethics. And so we were interested in Solomon's work, but very quickly we realized it doesn't apply very well to academic medical centers. It doesn't. We really have to assimilate it. The reason why is academic medical centers are really built around the principles of training professionals in quality health care, providing health care to the community, and doing scientific research in roughly equal portion. Okay. I didn't mention profit making as one of the agendas. Now, in business ethics, I don't want to say that the sole interest in business ethics is profit making, because that's naive, because indeed, I mean, if we look at pharmaceutical companies, they are absolutely interested in profit making. But the way they do it is by developing products to save lives. So I'm not going to condemn, people get very cynical about business ethics. Business ethics is a complex phenomenon too, because what business is about is achieving social goods with a profit. And that's not to diminish profit, it's not to diminish social goods. However, having said all that, academic medical centers are now at a crossroads, because we're now getting into the business of intellectual property. So, for example, at Southwestern Medical Centers, we're doing all kinds of genetic research, and we're finding things like biomarkers, molecular identities of diseases that we can then use to develop diagnostic tests. And these diagnostic tests are patentable. They can be genetic. They can be proteomic, that is, they could be unique proteins, etc. So we can develop these copyrightable products, which then become valuable in the business world, and so some of our faculty have now very complex relationships that are business-like on the one hand, but also in the context of the traditional noble vision of the academic medical center. And so one of the ethical issues that academic medical centers struggle with today is, what do we do with intellectual property? I mean, does the scientist who finds the new biomarker that identifies cancer before it's detectable by any other means, do we let that person keep the copyright even though they used UT Southwestern facilities to develop this brilliant new test? Do we share with the institution? Does this institution shuttle state taxpayer resources to develop copyrightable business intellectual property. Do you feel that that's a fair use of your tax dollar? So again, those, that's movement between the historical, what's the word, I guess I don't know, the historical charge of academic medical centers versus the sort of brave new world of intellectual property is one of the calls, I think, for the idea of institutional virtues, because I think our institutions have to deliberate upon these issues and they need intellectual tools to do that. Is that a roundabout way of answering your question?
More questions?
I have another one.
Well, nobody else raised their hand. Go for it.
I'm curious to understand the kind of the extent to which in your institutional setting versus, say, you know, in a business setting, there's a lot of focus on the customer and, you know, what's the product of our product and that kind of thing in terms of it as being a determinant to some extent as to what the organization does and how they do it and market and so on and so forth. So I'm kind of curious to know what's the historical perspective of your industry and is it changing? Or, I mean,
well, the second part is easy, yes.
I mean, other than looking at these customers as guinea pigs and people who have money.
The customer approach. You know, it's interesting you should ask that. I just read a very, very interesting paper today about, that was done by a medical anthropologist. A medical anthropologist is a cultural anthropologist, a person who studies culture, except they treat medical practices as cultures. Okay? So, so medical anthropologists, the colleague that I mentioned earlier that's doing the empirical portion of our, the scientific portion of our study, is a medical anthropologist. Anyway, this medical anthropologist did a study of the marketing mechanisms of Eli Lilly after a lawsuit that made a lot of their marketing materials publicly accessible, a matter of public record. And which were it was extensive. It's fascinating in that you get to see how in this Eli Lilly, one of the biggest pharmaceutical manufacturers in the country, markets to the public. And the principle that they use, that's come out in this paper, is it's the principle that we all get cynical about business, which is business tends to create needs where none exist. And so, for example, there's a phenomenon in medical sociology and medical anthropology called disease mongering. Psychiatry, my field, is one of the prime movers and shakers, or at least victims, depending on how you look at it. That is that diseases are identified and created so that people go out and buy drugs to treat them. The classic example in my field is social anxiety disorder, which a lot of people see as not too different than ordinary shyness, yet you can go out and get prescribed an antidepressant drug for your social anxiety disorder. Anyway, this study shows that part of the strategy of pharmaceutical companies is, you know, they have trademarks for new compounds that are bound by particular diseases. And so if you come out with a new antidepressant drug like Prozac, like which Lilly produced, that's only good for 8 to 10 years as a trademark, then any other pharma company can make a similar drug, a generic drug, and then their market share. This guy had data that within 2 months of the release of generic Prozac on the market, the market share of Lilly dropped for that compound dropped by 76% in 2 months. It went from being their number one product, multi-million dollar income per year, to being a trivial product for them. So what the drug companies do is that they develop what we call in medicine new indications, that is new diseases that this drug is good for. So over in that way, the copyright can be renewed, or the trademark can be renewed for this particular product, and the market share can be perpetuated as new needs for the drug or manufacturer. Now, having said all that, I want you all to leave really cynical, saying, oh, you know, well, it's all, pardon my French, bullshit. I mean, this is not just in psychiatry. It's the same thing happens with antibiotics and so forth. Just because these strategies are in motion doesn't mean the drugs necessarily don't work. Now, there's other reasons, I'm sorry to say, for you to doubt whether the drugs your doctors are prescribing you work, but that's for another discussion. So, to sort of get back then to your question about the customer approach, I think the fundamental morality of medicine is the idea that it's not about me, it's about you. And that's what I think needs to not be lost in academic medical centers, even with intellectual property interest and so forth, that we're not pursuing this just for our own interests, we're pursuing this primarily for the patient's interest. Whether that's possible or even probable, I don't know, but that's what I would like to say.
One comment before we apparently I gather what you're saying is that what you'd like to gather from your analysis is something that can be applied to the medical centers. But I guess like what you're saying, I don't know that it would be able to apply very well to for-profit operations, because you do have a profit motive that would inevitably play.
Right.
You've got a virtue, you go through this analysis, look at it critically and say, you know, as an institution, we'd like to do this more. And when on the other hand, you know, the accountants decide, yeah, we do that, and we read the money every day, and we'll assume we have a business, so what's the point of doing, you know, doing this nice thing if we're going to be out of business in a month anyhow? So my question then is, if you can't really necessarily apply your findings to a for-profit operation, at least not the right way to do it, it would be applicable to other non-profit type operation. I see some parallel between medical center and its...
Well, most medical centers and their hospital operations, if they own them, which many do, are organized as not-for-profit organizations, or even non-profits, depending. I mean, but it turns out the non-profits are not really financially viable anymore. A classic example is our own St. Paul Hospital, which was operated by the, you know, Catholic Church as part of their charitable mission. The nuns ran St. Paul for, you know, many, many years, most of you probably know, and they were losing their shirt, or their habit, I should say. And Southwestern came in and bought the institution, I don't know, six, seven years ago, something like that, and turned it into a not-for-profit, and so far so good. I mean, it's working as, you know, as a teaching hospital and as a private medical institution. I'm not sure I have enough business knowledge to really answer your question.
Well, I guess I'm thinking that I mean, that's the answer. Whether there's some parallel here as far as what can be gleaned from at the end when we get done and say this is what we can, with a way of going through it at an institutional level and say this is what we do, this is how we do it, maybe this is what other people think we should do, this is how our customers and our clients would like us to do it, and synthesize that together to say these are the virtues we want to pursue as an institution.
Yeah.
And then is that process of doing that transferable to at least other nonprofits or nonprofit entities?
Yeah.
Can say, you know, we only have a fixed amount of money to work with, say low income housing operations.
or other charitable operation, say, we have this amount of money, we can't serve everybody we want to, but this is the way, as an institution, we want to follow these policies, these principles, these virtues, to serve our party.
Yeah, I actually think there's, I mean, these ideas of pursuing the mean or pursuing balance and being wary of perversities or excesses, I think that, where they really have some on-the-ground applicability. One of the things that we've been talking about in our ethics group at Southwestern is a lot having to do with this conflict of interest business. And so one of the trends now is for many academic medical centers to forbid their faculty from having any sort of financial relationship with medical industries, pharmaceutical companies, drug device makers. And the reason why is that they think that it's influential in toxic ways in multiple directions. One is it confounds and renders the credibility of the clinical research, but also what we're also interested in is about the effect, for example, on if I'm making, you know, $75,000 a year from Eli Lilly, what am I teaching medical students and residents about Eli Lilly products, and is that really going to represent objective scientific perspective, or is that going to represent my familiarity, if not my loyalty, to the Lilly brand? And then it gets even more complicated. I have a colleague who's a cancer, ovarian cancer survivor, who is militant about the idea that physicians should have to disclose their financial interests in pharma, you know, in medical industries to patients. And I have a lot of ambivalence about that. I'd be really interested in y'all's response to that. Her basic idea is that she wants to know whether this person is objective or not. And she doesn't think that her doctor can be objective if they're on the take, so to speak, from the pharma companies.
Yes. Of course, the problem is not simply whether it's capable of being objective, but whether it distinguishes those who are from those who are not.
That's right.
It's, that gets you to a collective issue. Then you will end up with a reputation for the entire branch.
Yeah, I think you brought up very nicely the other side. So while it would be nice to know, the question is, once you know, then what do you do with the information? And to some extent, what gives me ethical hesitation about that is if I'm working, for example, with a desperately ill patient who needs to decide today about a treatment, and I burden him or her with all these details about my financial arrangements, if I have them, that seems to me to be burdening the patient rather than liberating to the patient, or at least the potential for that is there. Unless I was forbidden, to, you know, across the board from having any sorts of arrangements, then there would be nothing to disclose.
We've got 2 years. David, yeah, look, we haven't helped you very much, Dr. Dean, but
that's all right.
It seems to me that where the juxtaposition of the ecological model in the case study is pointing, you know, pretty obviously would be the analogy that it may look like the wolf pouncing on the sheep the way that the research sector is treated, but in ecological sense, maybe you have to ask, is the community match better, you know, right, with the presence of the institution or without it?
So, right. Yeah, well, then the idea is rather than waiting for the patients to come to you, you can always go to the community and find out what their needs are. And that way you can pursue a certain balance too. Yes?
No, I understood you wanted to address the point you just made with the way that you spoke. I can certainly understand what you're saying, especially somebody who's just been hit with a really devastating diagnosis or something. You don't want to say, I've got this lab here. But wouldn't it be appropriate just to ask them if it is of interest you would be prepared to disclose it? In other words, just give them that information. You never know who you've got as a patient. They may be vibrant. And if I have a legal background, I'd certainly want to know about it.
Well, in my view, it would be certainly appropriate as a patient to ask your doctor, you know, what's the deal? Do you have interest in drug companies, particularly this drug that you're offering me? And I think the doctor should answer. I think they should feel obligated to answer. I think many physicians would. I hope all would, but I'm not sure I can promise that. I think your approach is reasonable, just from my own clinical experience, and if you've been looking at actual research in terms of what people actually want to know about their medicines, there's enormous variability. Some people want to know every last detail. They want and will go home and read the PDR on their own. Okay, there's this, there's, okay, I'll go over here. And then there's the person on this end who says, doctor, you just decide. I don't want to know. And so you don't want to, you know, again, you want to sort of respect what the patient wants.
As the resident objectivist, a couple of comments, and the whole philosophy of giving back to the community.
Yeah.
I think you would have to decide on altruists, right? Isn't the giving back enough, or is that the given that the community hospital has to give back to the community?
Well, I think. I probably should explain what we mean by community engagement. And the model for that, for me, is what the Southwestern faculty have done with the so-called Dallas Heart Study. And the idea here is we wanted to do extensive studies in minority populations, primarily in South Dallas, about hypertension and heart disease and how they're apparently, in many ways, these populations respond to medications and stuff differently than North Dallas populations. And the way this was accomplished is by going to them and not just saying, look, we have this really exciting research study. Do you want to participate? What they do is they go in and do educational programs about heart disease in the community, provide services to the community, and then the community is trustful and more likely to engage in a dialogue about participating in clinical research. And so there's this real reciprocity involved. With
you're good traders. You know, you know, objectivism was all about that, the trade. Uh-huh. And I think the hospital, you should measure it more on the patients. When you talked about you had 5,000 employees, Ayn Rand and her philosophy was all based on the value of to men's life. Uh-huh. Everything was measured, started on the basic, and went from there, the value to men's life. And I think, who's more important in the business of life than hospitals, right? For y'all to measure the amount of lives you improve every year, the amount of lives you save every year. You know, that's the virtue, that's the value of the hospital, you know.
Right. I don't think you would have many people arguing with you about that.
Well, but then there's this, you know, giving back to the community, or, hey, let's go ask the taxpayers for $1.2 billion so we can build a new hospital and pay interest on the note, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what I would have a problem with, the whole idea that the tax dollars that have to, you know, I don't know, what are the numbers for New Parkland Hospital, you know, what the community has to pour into that for the community. I think that what you brought up, the case of the doctor doing the work, getting the, benefit of a patent on a new drug, that should be the property of the hospital. And the hospital should profit from that and pile that right back into
their
future
mission.
Studies, bigger buildings, being able to teach better doctors. There's no way that doctor should be able to walk out the door with that patent.
Well, let me just point out the pragmatic problem with not with the institution getting the rewards solely. The problem then is the doctor says, hey, I'm a pretty smart guy. I'm going to go work for Eli Lilly, and I'll make a whole lot more money, and they will. Or what they do is they start their own biotech firm, and then they make all the money, and then it's lost to the academic medical center. So, you know, there is a certain amount of give and take, as you've suggested, that so that everyone, so that there's more of this collectivist sort of benefit. Bob?
I think you have a very good project in mind, but I have some misgivings about the concept of virtue. Virtue is very, the whole concept is very ambiguous. You know, Aristotle had his virtues, and Plato talked about virtue. Solomon would have a different kind of Bob, because he was an existentialist.
Uh-huh.
And as for existentialists, this whole business of virtue and ethics is, you know, it's situational.
Yeah. From my reading, and he's more
you can
ordinary
take any
language,
particular huh? action. You see, and it can be virtuous and it can be non-virtuous at the same time. Let's say a doctor, a practicing doctor, not a medical student, a practicing doctor, is taking some gifts, lunches or whatever, from a pharmaceutical company, but at the same time that pharmaceutical company is loading him up with samples to give to his patients. And he turns around and gives those samples to somebody who can't afford the medicines and gives them a whole bunch of them for free and keeps them alive.
That's right.
There's an ambiguity. And see, I don't see where you're going to come out with any specific virtues from your whole study. That's what I don't understand. It's going to be very ambiguous. Yes, well, here, no there.
Yeah. Well, I think actually, again, I mean, you may be right. Otherwise, we don't do studies in order to just fulfill our own viewpoints. We would like to be able to falsify our hypotheses. That's why we do them. So you may be absolutely right. There are layers upon layers of ambiguity. We discuss your case with our residents fairly frequently, and it gets even more difficult in that. So, for example, you give the free medicines, the samples, to the needy patient. Ultimately, the samples will run out. The trademark will run out. You'll run out of samples, and the patient will need to stay on that medicine, will have to pay for what now is an excessively expensive medicine compared to cheaper generics that you could have prescribed in the first place. On the flip side, there's still even more mess to it.
Generic at that time.
There's still even more mess to it. The fact that you have samples also doesn't address, the convenience of the sample doesn't address what medication would actually be the best one for your patient. So you may have samples of drug B, but what the best drug for this person is drug A. Although drug B's okay, it's just not as good as drug A. So these things will, you know, have their own ways of catching up with you, so to speak.
So we're back to the basic virtue of all medicine, the old Hippocratic oath.
That's another discussion.
That's all you need.
I have another question here. I mean,
yes.
You're talking about, I mean, you mentioned like the ecological forms, where you've got the wolves and stuff. On one level, it's a really bad thing, and on another level, it's a good thing. Is part of your effort defining these different levels? How they relate to each other?
I'm not sure I even want to define them because I wouldn't want to make this all concretized. I don't think, I mean, philosophy, as much as we try to systematize it, they're just things that resist being systematized. And that's why we have existentialists. So in a certain sense, I wouldn't want to define levels. What I would want to do is define maybe some principles of discourse. That is, to talk about ways that we can talk about these problems that are illuminating. That's what I would hope would come out of a study like ours.
Any more questions?
Carl? Under Aristotle's analysis of nature and form and ends, the wolf, for example, examining the virtue of a wolf and like what a wolf is and what a wolf is might be.
Speak up again, because the fan's really competing.
Aristotle's analysis of a creature, its virtue in terms of its nature and its ends, which are kind of up with its nature. I wonder if that could be applied to groups and institutions.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I was getting at with the idea of mission statements. But again, the problem with mission statements, anyone that's worked in a committee or worked in a business, you know, that there's not necessarily 100% coherence between what we say we're going to do and what we actually do. That's why you need on-the-ground study of the kind that we just, you know, what I described earlier.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.